Hello, this is Jeff Wine with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Key Realty in Port Huron. I would like to go to work for you. Contact me at 810-650-6255 or email me at jeff@porthuronhomes.com.
All right, 10 minutes past 9 o'clock. If you are at all a fan of music, you'll be a fan of our next guest's new book called Shaping Sound, Stevie Wonder, Devo, The Synth Revolution, and My Life Behind the Music. It's by Robert Margalef, who's on the line with us right now. Robert, good morning.
Good morning to you.
It's such a fascinating...
How's the weather over there?
Getting better. I'll tell you that. It's getting better. It should be nice today. It's interesting when you connect all the dots.
I've been watching the telly, and they've been saying you guys have been having some fairly heavy weather in your neighborhood.
Yeah, it's getting better, and we should have a nice day today. It's starting to feel a little bit more like summer. It's interesting to connect the dots, Robert, in your life and your career. You were working on a film with Andy Warhol, and it led you to using the Moog synthesizer, which led to your work with Stevie Wonder. Help us connect all that together.
Well, I was working with the refugees from Andy Warhol's factory. It was the height of psychedelia in New York. It was the scene, the underground scene. It sort of was like visiting Blade Runner in a way. But I ended up, I was in the service a few years before that, and I was trained as a combat photographer. So I really fancied myself as a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make the first above-ground underground movie, and I teamed up with a whole bunch of refugees from the factory and started making a movie called Chow Manhattan. In the process of doing that, I discovered the Moog synthesizer in a nightclub called Cerebrum in the Lower East Side of New York one late rainy night, and I said, this is the way to score the movie. And once I discovered the synthesizer and starting to score the film, I ran headlong with my arms wide into the arms of electronica, and I never looked back. With the synthesizer, I'd finally found my voice as a musician.
What was it about the synthesizer that you liked so much?
Well, it was every instrument. A synthesizer is not an instrument that is built to imitate other instruments. A synthesizer is used really to create sounds that never existed before in space. The sounds that come out of a synthesizer the first time you hear them, if they come out of a loudspeaker, it's not an acoustic instrument, and it's not polyphonic. More modern ones you can, but the ones we were working with were all monophonic. One note, one sound. And if you wanted two sounds, then you had to use two separate keyboards. So, and more. And before, we had four keyboards that we used with Stevie, for example. But one note, one event, basically, could be combinations of many oscillators and envelope generators and other kind of electronic gizmos. Today, we call them Euro racks, mm-hmm. and they're much smaller. Tonto, my synthesizer, weighed about a half a ton. It was 14 wow. feet in diameter, and you lived inside of it. So it was a very different time, you might say.
What was it like to work with Stevie Wonder in this period where you were sort of discovering the magic of the synth together, weren't you?
Yes, we really, the synthesizer is a forest of knobs and dials and patch cords and stuff in those days. And as long as we could manage those and whip up some great sounds with Steve, he could man the keyboards, mm-hmm. and we built some specialized things, one thing called a pitch bender, which we made from a model airplane controller, from a joystick, so that we could bend the notes, which was not possible before that, and that's what really made it possible to play the blues. A great example of that would be found on Stevie's song called Boogie on Reggae Woman, for example. You can hear him starting to use the bender notes. Steve got the synthesizer in under 30 seconds. He really was insightful. He's quite a guy, and as the mind of, of a steel trap. I can remember we were working on a song called Living for the City back in the day, and I recently asked him, what do you remember about that song? He says, it was raining. You know, here it is, what, 60 years later?
Yeah.
And he remembers that it was raining on the day we tracked it. The guy is incredible and a beautiful human being to boot, I must say. We've been friends since 1972.
Wow.
So he's still out there batting it over the fence, you know?
Yeah, he is.
And that makes me very happy indeed.
You also write about your longtime partner, Malcolm Cecil. Tell us a little bit more about Malcolm.
Malcolm was an English-Jewish guy. I'm a Jewish guy from New York, so we spanned the globe a little bit that way. I met Malcolm at Media Sound. He was the chief technologist of the studio. He was also probably one of the finest upright bass players walking the planet. And he was also a first-class technician. When I met him, he was the chief of engineering at Media Sound in New York. And he said, he looked over at my synthesizer, which is in the ISO room studio, and he said, if you teach me how to play that, I'll really teach you how to become a very fastidious recording engineer. I was a recording engineer before, but not at the level of Malcolm. Malcolm also played in the back line at Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club in London, which is still going to this day.
Wow.
But the back line, people like Charlie Watts and Jeff Beck and all kinds of rockers from that time played on the back line at Ronnie Scott's, because musicians, jazzers would come to play, but they didn't travel with their bands because it was too expensive. So Malcolm was the bass player in the back line of the Blues Project, which was the house band of Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club. So when we met, we really hit it off, because he was an incredible thinking man, but also an incredible musician and performer. And the two of us put the Tonto, as we now call it, the original Neo Timbrel Orchestra, together. And that's what Stevie worked with. It was sort of the precursor of Tonto.
Robert, what are your thoughts on the future of music? Because technology has grown by leaps and bounds since you got into the business. Where do you see technology taking music?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because we're at a very interesting juncture. I will say this. Technology drives the art. I'll say it again. Technology drives the art. And by that I mean, as the technology changes, how we make music changes. I think, you know, there are a lot of people that are saying AI is destroying the music business, that we're making tons of, somebody can make 50 songs in a week and overload Spotify and do all kinds of things. Yeah, there's a lot of problems ahead of us. But I say, if you're working with AI, you need to really embrace it and understand it, and don't use it with ignorance. Really, learn how to use it. It is a new musical instrument, in a way. Some people say it's like making love to a vending machine. Well, that's possible, too, depending on how you approach it as a creative.
Yeah.
But I think that it's here, and I think we need to embrace it and understand it and use it in the most artful and creative way we can.
Interesting.
It's a new musical instrument. I mean, you know, we've listened to Bach on the piano, on the clavier. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Bach was writing on the clavichord, not on a piano. It wasn't invented. And yet we listened to his music on a piano, which was 200 years younger than Bach.
That's a great point.
We're sort of in the same place now. The wheel is turning, and I think we're in the place of new instruments and new approach to art and music, and we need to embrace it and take our heads out of the sand.
There you go. Robert, great talking to you. Appreciate it. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Have a beautiful day.
You as well. Bye-bye.